Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Switzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with the author of a publication that appears in the May 2018 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Stavros G. Mimsoudas. Dr. Mimsoudas is the first author of an article titled Association of Multimodal Pain Management Strategies with Perioperative Outcomes and Resource Utilization, a Population-Based Study. Dr. Stavros G. Mimsoudas is a professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and Public Health at Weill Cornell Medical College and a senior scientist at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, New York. He is also a professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and Departments of Perioperative Medicine and Intensive Care Medicine, Paracelsus Medical University, Salzburg, Austria. Welcome, Dr. Mimsoudas.
Thank you for having me, Bobby.
So can we start with you maybe giving us an overview of what question or questions you wanted to answer with this study?
Sure. The purpose of this study was to identify the utilization patterns of multimodal pain management in patients undergoing joint arthroplasty in the United States. And we wanted to do that by using a population-based approach. We wanted to study trends in the use of multimodal analgesia and determine how an increasing number of modes used could affect pain management approaches and would be associated with perioperative opioid prescription, clinical outcomes, things like including opioid-related adverse effects, as well as resource utilization, meaning length of stay. And the specific focus was to quantify a potential incremental effect of additional modes used on these outcomes.
Sounds like a big project. So maybe we can start with your defining for us what multimodal analgesia is and what benefits it, at least theoretically, offers.
Multimodal analgesia is defined by the simultaneous administration of more than two analgesic agents or analgesic techniques, for that matter, targeting pain pathways at various levels. This approach is used to improve pain control while also aiming to reduce opioid utilization and related adverse effects. And practitioners have used a various number or various types of medications to achieve that, including anti-inflammatory agents, steroids, acetaminophen, gabapentinoids, COX-2 inhibitors, and opioids. So that would be one definition that we used. I'm sure that there are others, but this is one that I've widely been aware of.
So before your study was published, what was the scientific evidence supporting multimodal techniques?
I think there was some very good evidence suggesting that multimodal analgesia is indeed effective in achieving the goals of better pain control and opioid reduction. What we have very little concrete data about, however, is how physicians use multimodal analgesia in various practice settings throughout the country, what the national trends are in its use, and importantly, if the use of increasing number of modes is really related to an incremental improvement in outcomes, specifically complications related to opioid utilization and resource utilization. So we know that they are being used, they are effective in pain control, but do they really reduce the complications that we all worry about? You see, there are many studies out there that investigate all kinds of combinations of drugs and making them very heterogeneous, not very comparable to each other. So there's a lot of confusion really out there. What is the best approach for what type of patient? What combination is best? It is not unusual to see today, you know, ERAS protocols, meaning early recovery after surgery protocols, that include pretty much any medication under the sun that remotely could affect pain at all. And there's no good evidence that this combination is actually helpful or even necessary or efficacious. So we practice a lot of non-evidence-based medicine, and the goal here was to put some more evidence behind the idea of using increasing number of these types of medications on outcomes.
Yeah, I remember reading something once that only about 5% of medical practices are grounded in really strong evidence.
That would be very encouraging, actually.
So let's talk a little bit about what you did with this study. And I have a sort of a series of questions. Maybe I'll just ask you all of them, and then you can address them. So this was not a randomized controlled trial, as I recall. So I hope you can tell us what type of study it actually was, and who were your subjects, and what types of surgeries did they have?
Okay, so let's start by defining the population a little bit. So this was a retrospective study with a population-based cohort that included 1.5 million patients undergoing hip and knee arthroplasty. And those patients underwent these procedures in over 500 hospitals in the United States, and the time frame was 2006 to 2016. This data set represents a real-world sample from all types of hospital, meaning teaching, community hospital, large, small, you name it, different locations, and includes also all kinds of practice patterns. So unlike RCTs, there are no patient-related exclusion criteria or protocols that are being used to derive these data. They're basically all-comer patients that are being included in here as long as they had primary total hip or knee arthroplasty. These type of studies have become very popular in recent years because they allow us to analyze low-incidence outcomes with the actual population without the confines of RCTs, and I think we may talk about this a little later. RCTs are usually done at academic single institutions in selected populations, thus reducing their external validity. We don't really know what does this mean for the small community hospital if I do a study in a university hospital that is very specialized. And therefore, you know, it leaves us wondering if those data are really valid for the community out there. However, it must be mentioned that they also have downsides, such as the risk of residual confounding and the inability of draw causal conclusions. They do get us a step closer to the truth by characterizing practice patterns, but, you know, they also allow us to identify associations. But we really can never for sure say that there is a causal relationship between what we find and what we observe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, each different type of study has its advantages and disadvantages, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you used something that was called the Premier Perspective Database. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. So this database is a private database, and I say private because there are others like the NIST data set or the NHDS, which is run by the CDC or the AHRQ. So this one is actually from the private sector, and it contains detailed all-payer patient-specific information on inpatients from hundreds of hospitals around the country. And it represents a convenience sample. So these are not, randomly selected or clustered hospitals that are being included to create a national representative sample. So they are basically hospitals that decide to participate in this collaborative. It includes about 20% of all hospitalizations per year in the United States. And patient records include ICD-9 codes, which then we can use to determine comorbidities or complications. Pharmaceutical information is included through billing data, which then allows us to identify certain types of medications, but also services provided, like the type of anesthesia being used, for example.
That's a pretty big population of one-fifth of all cases being done in the U.S.
Yes, that is indeed. And that's what makes it so powerful.
Yes, yes. So I think you mentioned one of the limitations was confounders, but can you discuss any other limitations of using data from either this database or just similar databases?
Sure. So there are many downsides. Obviously, as you said, residual confounding is always a problem, the inability to draw causal conclusions another. And there's always risk of coding errors. Despite good quality assurance procedures, this remains a problem. We try to deal with it as best as possible by doing sensitivity analyses, but being something that is a data set entered by people, there's always a risk of errors. This and many other databases does not allow for longitudinal analysis of patients, meaning that I cannot follow a patient over multiple hospitalizations. Although there is readmissions that are being captured, as long as the patient actually gets readmitted to the participating hospitals, if they go to a hospital that does not participate, I will not actually be able to see this in this data set. We also do not have access to clinical detailed information, such as actual blood loss, for example, or vital signs. But there are things, that we can use as surrogate markers, in this case, in terms of blood loss, blood transfusions, which are built for. So we can approximate the actual variable of interest, or we create something called string variables by using different types of information to get to a particular type of variable of interest. So in summary, there are quite a few downsides associated with these databases, but as I said, they get us a step closer to the truth and allow us to identify associations, which then hopefully can use to generate new hypotheses and pinpoint what we should be studying in clinical studies.
So why not just do a prospective randomized control trial?
The obvious reason for it is really when you're looking at low incidence outcomes, the numbers needed to do these studies are just vast, which makes it time-consuming and very expensive. So thus, using this approach to generate hypotheses may allow us to really kind of focus on to the questions that are really at the heart of a problem, and therefore focus our efforts in randomized controlled trials on really those specific aspects. RCTs themselves have downsides, artificial inclusion and exclusion criteria. As I mentioned earlier, not every patient gets included. So the ones that we really may want to have information about, like the 88-year-old with coronary artery disease or, you know, all kinds of other comorbidities, is frequently excluded in randomized controlled trials, which then, again, becomes a problem for the external validity of those data. But, you know, both study designs obviously have their role, and both of them have benefits and downsides.
Sure. So I think you gave us the big overview of the study and kind of what you were looking for, but can you give us a little more specifics about the outcomes?
The specific outcomes that we were really looking here for were the opioid prescription levels associated with different levels of multimodal anesthesia use, so meaning looking into the amount of opioids prescribed differ by the number of multimodal analgesics used. Did the number of multimodal anesthesia had anything to do with opiate-related side effects? So was the use of multimodal anesthesia at these various levels able to reduce opiate-related side effects, which is really what we're looking for when we're reducing opioids? And then resource utilization, meaning specifically length of stay. Did the use of multimodal anesthesia at various levels have a differential impact on length of stay? So those three categories, basically.
So before we get into what you found, I want to cover just a few things about the population in a little more detail. What kind of types of anesthetics did these patients have, and what were the various analgesic modes that were employed?
These patients had, you know, like in real life, various types of anesthetics. Two-thirds of them had general anesthesia and the rest neuraxial anesthesia. And the multimodal approaches or medications that we looked at included patient-controlled analgesia through, you know, with opioids, NSAIDs, COX-2 inhibitors, ketamine, pregabalin and gabapentin, acetaminophen, steroids, and peripheral nerve blocks. So those were the specific types of modes that we looked at.
So I'm kind of surprised that two-thirds of the patients had general anesthesia.
That continues to surprise us, despite good evidence that specifically hip and knee arthroplasties seem to be doing better and have less complications when regional anesthesia is being used. In some specialized institutions like ours, who pretty much use neuraxial anesthesia for pretty much every patient, seem to still be the exception. If you look on a national basis, these numbers held true 10 years ago, and they don't seem to move much. So about two-thirds still receive general anesthesia as opposed to neuraxial anesthesia. Same thing with the use of peripheral nerve blocks. Huh. So we have to see and wonder what needs to be done to change that. As I said, there is mounting evidence that the neuraxial anesthetic approach, especially in these type of patients, may be the better choice. But again, there are many factors that play into this.
Well, much as we were talking about evidence, I remember reading someplace that I think it takes an average of 17 years for a guideline or a practice to be translated from the science into everyday kind of, you know, utilization. So
that is correct. I remember reading that as well.
Way too long of a delay, but I'm surprised, too, that you know, because you were looking, you said this data, I think, was 2006 to 2016, that there doesn't even seem to be any change over that 10-year period.
Yeah, very slight, and certainly not consistent. And I wonder if that is really a, the concept of it takes a generation to change behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of gets close to the 17 years. So I wonder what it really will take. Yep.
Interesting. So did you look at all the patients in the database having hip and knee arthroplasties over this 10-year period?
We restricted ourselves to only primary hip and knee arthroplasty patients. Mm-hmm. But other than that, we tried to include all of them and just excluded just a small amount of number of patients when they didn't have, for example, information on gender or very basic patient-related information. We also did a sub-analysis to look into patients that had very extreme levels, or like exclude patients that had very extreme levels of opioid prescription, meaning those over 95%, just because we were wondering if that was somehow representing a group of patients that had very special circumstances that would bias our data. But we did the analysis with and without, and that didn't seem to affect outcomes very much, or at all, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, we try to be as inclusive as possible.
So a large number of patients.
That's true.
So I recall you assessed comorbidity burden using individual Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities. Can you explain what this means?
Yes. For the purpose of identifying comorbidities in databases such as these, there are various approaches that have been used in the past. The Carlson Comorbidity Index, for example, is one such approach where you use a set of ICD-9 codes to identify overall comorbidity burden, and those ICD-9 codes represent certain diseases that are very common. They're being assigned a weight, and that weight then gets factored into an overall index. The Ehlers-Danlos method is a little bit more focused on a larger group of individual comorbidities, which I think is a little bit more comprehensive, and there's really no right or wrong which method you use, but for this purpose, we really used the Ehlers-Danlos approach, which allowed us to take into account a larger number of individual comorbidities. And we factored that basically into our multivariable regression model.
I'm less familiar with that than I am with the Charlson.
It's actually a little bit of a newer method, but again, as I said, we looked into this many times to see which one would be better, but the reality is it doesn't really matter much as long as you pick the comorbidities or the approach that serves your purpose best.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're equally useful.
I get it. So how did you adjust or account for the fact that patients who had more pain simply may have required and or been given more opioids or additional analgesic drugs?
So this is a very good point, and this is one of those problems we have with databases that we don't have that clinical detail. So, for example, I did not have any access to pain scores. So the short answer is I really couldn't adjust for this. However, what we do is we try to get as close to, adjusting for these variables as possible. For example, we included ICD-9 codes that would identify preoperative history of substance abuse or pain conditions or psychiatric comorbidities, or the final one was opioid use disorder. So these would be patients or conditions that we would think would put someone at increased likelihood to require higher doses of opioids. So by adjusting for those conditions, we try to adjust for this problem. However, as you mentioned, this does not capture every patient that may have had increased pain that is not included in those categories.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a downside and a problem or limitation of our analysis.
Mm-hmm. But like you said, a real-world problem.
Mm-hmm.
So one more question about your methods before we get to the findings. You talk about an initial a priori specified analysis, mm-hmm. and I think you made some adjustments based on this for your further analysis. Can you help our listeners and me understand what this step entailed and why you performed this and what adjustments were made?
So this is a very good example of how the peer review process is actually helpful in improving a paper. And what happened here, we set out with a specific question, an analysis plan, and basically followed that plan. But during the review process, there were questions that came up by the reviewers who then requested us to look into, you know, additional information and try to include that into our analysis. One for the, of them, for example, was a comment that mentioned that peripheral nerve blocks are already known to provide great pain management, and it's the standard of care in many institutions performing these type of procedures routinely. I would argue now, if you look at the numbers of how many patients actually do get peripheral nerve blocks, which is about 1/4, is it really the standard of care? But I understand the comment made, and we then did a post hoc analysis where we defined our baseline pain management approach not only as opioids, which we originally did, but as opioids plus peripheral nerve blocks. So that would have been then considered the baseline pain management approach that we compared everything else to. So that, for example, would be a post hoc analysis that we added to this paper after our initial analysis and after this paper went through peer review.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear you say that there was some advantages to peer review. I think it's come under fire occasionally and questioned the value and even whether it could be detrimental to allowing science to be, you know, widely publicized. So it's interesting to hear as an author that you actually felt the peer review process had some benefits.
Yes.
I'm sure that a lot of reviewers out there have spent a lot of time will be happy to hear that.
Yeah, well, you know, you and I probably review too, and that once in a while we're sympathetic to those comments.
Yes, I do review, and I hope that the authors see it as added value, not just as criticisms. So did you find that multimodal analgesia had advantages, and if so, what were they?
Yes, and that was a pretty striking and resounding yes you know, to that answer when we finished with this analysis. So what we did find was that the number of modes used in a multimodal management approach indeed had an impact, an incremental impact, on the reduction of opioid prescription as well as opioid-related side effects. What that means is the more modes that were used, meaning one, two, or two plus, compared to opioids alone, that had an incremental benefit on all the outcomes that we studied. In addition to that, we did a sub-analysis of what types of medications were actually associated with the biggest benefit in those outcomes, and we were able to identify that non-steroidal analgesics and COX-2 inhibitors were the two modalities with the biggest impact on opioid prescription. And in third place came peripheral nerve blocks. So we concluded that, you know, those three are probably cornerstones of any multimodal analgesic protocol that should be used. I will say that what we weren't able to answer yet is what combination of all these medications would have been the best one, and that is really a methodological problem as much as a computing problem, is that the combinations are just so manifold that running all these analyses would require a whole different study and much more time. And finally, I think the other outcome was that, you know, the trends over time, we identified that people really started using multimodal analgesia with more than two modes more frequently throughout the study period, and during the same time, opioid-only use drastically fell, which is, I think, a good a testament to the anesthesia community that, you know, way before the opioid crisis became big, we started recognizing the problem and tried to actually fix things.
That's great news. So how often was multimodal analgesia used?
It depends when you look at what point in time, but overall, multimodal analgesia was used in 86% of patients, which you might say is actually great. It's the vast majority. But on the other side, one has to wonder, after decades of information suggesting that multimodal analgesia is associated with better pain control and decreased opioid consumption, why is it not everyone? 86% is great. The question is, why not everyone?
So you're saying 14% of patients received only opioids?
Correct.
Wow. Yeah, that's still quite high.
Yes, it is.
So So was there a difference in the multimodal analgesia used between those patients who had general anesthesia versus those who had regional for their anesthetic?
It seems that there was actually a difference. There was a trend towards decreased use of multimodal analgesia with multiple types of medications with general anesthesia. What specifically we saw was that patients who had general anesthesia, 72% of those patients had opioids only, while 2-plus modes, so more than 2 modes plus opioids, was only 66%. When you looked at neuraxial anesthesia patients, that actually was pretty much even across the board. So those patients all received pretty steady levels of multimodal analgesia.
Hmm. So I wonder if you have any perspective on that. Do you think it was just that perhaps the people who are more aware of the benefits of regional in this group of patients are more likely to also be aware of the benefits of multimodal?
That is very likely. The data certainly open themselves up to that interpretation, but it comes back to the limitation of these databases that we can identify associations, but not really causality. So we don't really know why people did it, but it makes perfect sense that people who are anesthesiologists who are aware of neuraxial anesthetic benefits are also aware of those associated with multimodal analgesia, and then will combine those two practice patterns to achieve those kind of findings that we find here in this data analysis.
So maybe the need to make sure we advertise and continue to push the benefits of both of those, the regional and the multimodal.
I could not agree more.
It also sort of begs the question, you know, if the evidence supports something, how do we get practitioners to, I guess, practice evidence-based medicine? Is it the payers that need to control this? We know that there's quite variability, right, in medical practices.
Yeah.
And sometimes there isn't a good answer, but I think when the evidence begins to stack up, and this study of yours is another, you know, great piece of information that we have now, is it time that CMS or the insurers insist that patients have these kinds of opportunities to have multimodal or regional anesthesia? Or,
you know, personally, I would like to see that pure education and interest on physician sides will actually do the trick. However, I understand that there will always be barriers to implementation of new findings, either because people are not interested in reading the literature or they feel that their practice approach is being encroached on. However, we see more and more of these outside agencies having an impact on practice and more also patients' expectations having an impact. More and more patients come in educated about anesthesia and medicine in general. And my patients, for example, I see many patients asking me specifically, what can I do to reduce opioid consumption? I don't want to take opioids. And I think it's going to take a combination of all of this, education, government or payer interventions, and patient education to really push us to do more to implement effective medical practice sooner and more consistently.
Mm-hmm. So what questions do you think remain to be answered to better understand multimodal analgesia and the most optimal approaches?
Right. So what we weren't able to answer here is what combinations of medications are actually the most effective and in what type of patients. As we know, not every patient is the same, and some patients may have contraindications to certain types of medications. So I will have to always have the ability to be able to adjust my plan in those type of patients. We should not forget that just because they're not opioids, these other types of medications we use have also side effects. And we weren't able to really dive into the association of the use of these types of medication and their respective side effects. You know, NSAIDs are known to potentially cause kidney failure, for example. Gabapentinoids, there may have been some evidence recently linking it to increased rates of delirium. So the reality is we still don't know what the best combination is and in what patient these combinations should be used and how they should be adjusted.
Well said. So if you were going to have a hip or knee arthroplasty tomorrow or next week, what anesthetic and analgesic regimens would you desire?
Okay. So I think I've had enough time to think about this, particularly because, you know, I have access to the information. And to be very straightforward, I think I would like to have a neuraxial anesthetic, probably a straight spinal anesthetic to avoid, prolonged bladder catheterization if I were to have an epidural or anything like that, or and I wanted to be able to get mobilized as fast as possible. So spinal anesthetic, a peripheral nerve block for pain control. If I had a knee replacement, I'm not sure I would want one for a hip replacement because I don't quite believe that every patient has enough pain after hip replacement to warrant a nerve block, although we do have good evidence that nerve blocks in hip patients may decrease complications. And then, if I believe my own data, an NSAID, a COX-2 inhibitor, and I think I'd be good.
And you think with no opioids you'd be able to do this?
That's a good question. You caught me there. I do think that opioids actually have a very legitimate role to play. I do think that we have relied on opioids too much for too long, and we need to do everything we can to minimize their role. However, I would not want to be exposed to the possibility of not having access to them, because I do feel opioids have a legitimate role to play. They're great analgesics, and they need to be used as adjuvants to any pain management approach, or at least have the ability to access them if needed, even if the goal is to have opioid-free analgesia. But yes, I actually would like to have opioids available to me if needed.
I like the way you stated that. You said it's adjuvants. I think in the past we've approached it the other way around, that these other drugs and methods are adjuvants to opioids often.
Correct. So I think a role reversal is really needed.
Uh-huh. Well said. So I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article to learn more. Thank you, Dr. Mimsudas, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.